All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And welcome once again to another edition of Veterans Radio, coming to you right here from the Garden Spot of the Midwest, the Garden Spot of Michigan, Ann Arbor, right here in downtown Ann Arbor. And we're broadcasting from the studios of WAAM Talk Radio 1600. Wow, I've been waiting for this program that we have today. We're going to be talking about badass. That's right. Who has got the most? We did this a couple of months back. And we got a lot of good response from you folks. You like to hear this. I brought back the same panel of historians, writers, authors that we have on our standby staff, and they're ready to be talking about the leaders of World War II, both in Korea and both in Europe and in the tropics over there in the Pacific. So we'll get to them in just a minute, but I did want to, because some of you folks didn't hear, we had Dr. Rebecca Grant on last week, and she talked about a lot of things, folks, you know, and you really want to go to our archives, and this lady spells it all out. Don't worry about the immigration problem in Mexico. The problem we have is North Korea, period. And listen to her. They've got a missile that'll reach the western part of our country. They've got a hydrogen bomb. That's scary. That's really scary. Ooh. Anyway, you want to hear that? Go to our archives. It's on there. So we also were covering that about a week ago, generals in the Army and the Marines approached Congress about changing the draft law and having women in the draft. And, will that be controversial? I don't know. And I was hoping to have somebody else talk a little bit about that today. That didn't take place. But Dr. Rebecca Grant, last week, took a moment or two to comment at the end of the program on just women in the military, women in combat. And, well, you folks got that all queued up? We're all set to go. Thumbs are up. Let's hear that piece right now.
I think we want to come back and talk about the changes for women in the military.
Let's do that.
To wrap up on that,
yeah,
I think you've noticed that. And, you know, the fact is we've had women serving in probably 97% of the specialties for a long time. And so what Congress has said and the Army and Marine Corps Chiefs of Staff have said, that's right, let's open everything up. The women will compete on equal footing with men for those last few specialties where they're not included at the moment. They're not going to lower the standards, but they're going to let those women who qualify go ahead and do it. And I think women will register for the draft. To me, that's kind of a non-event. I'm in favor of having them register. But we know we have a volunteer force, and that's the core of our U.S. military right now is that volunteer force. So, sure, let's open up the registration. That seems fair. But remember, we really are looking for a volunteer force. And so those women who can now seek out those specialties that were closed to them before, good for them. I know there are women who can handle those jobs, and I want to see them have the opportunity to compete for them.
Wow. And if you all want to hear that again, you can go to our archives, go to veteransradio.net, go to our archives. That's at the very end of the program. In fact, you probably want to hear the whole program. But I don't know. It's really cool when they come on the air and they say stuff like that. I mean, you're hearing it. You're hearing it right from the folks that make the news, that write about the news. Well, we're going to be right back. Oh, by the way, we're kind of taking an we just may talk to a couple of our historians today at the end of the program about that. And you know, we're not looking for any knuckle draggers, nothing like that. No. 2 weeks ago, we had Holly McGull, and you know, she was 19 years old. She was in combat. Hey, you're not supposed to be in combat. Women can't handle it. Oh, really? Tell that to her mother every time she goes to the grave. So, yes, women have been and will be in combat. Yeah, they can handle it, guys. Well, they're not strong enough. Oh, really? I haven't seen too many guys have a baby. Yeah, take that one back, right? Right. Okay, I know. I have a couple of guests with me in the studio today, so it's I'm not talking to myself necessarily, which I do a lot of. But anyway, we're going to be right back with our historians and somebody from the Frankenmuth, Michigan Military History Museum and space. Don't forget space. We got to get some space in there. All right. We'll be right back right after this very important message. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600. Don't go away. And we're back on Veterans. Oh, the band. They had to get a couple more notes in there. The band, take a break, guys. We'll be talking to you at the end of the program. So we've done this. I love this. Grit. What is the definition of grit? Look it up. Google it. There actually is a definition for grit. And we're not talking about the stuff on your shoes. We're talking about what did they possess, our leaders of World War II in Korea? That's what I'm singling out today. And our very distinguished guests, historians, you've seen them all three on the History Channel, on the Military Channel, on just about every channel that's available for history. They've written numerous books. Well, let me start with the first one, Kevin Hemel. Kevin Hemel's on the line. He's our Skype guy today. He's former historian for the U.S. Army Combat Studies Institute. Boy, let me talk about no one's thought. He's wrote military history narratives on the war in Afghanistan. He's the author of, and folks, you want a nice coffee table book. You want to buy, and today is Valentine's Day. It's still not too late to go to the bookstore. And it's photographs, Patton's photographs, and Patton as the war is how he saw it. It's really cool. George Patton taking photographs of his involvement, and it's firsthand. He's also, Kevin wrote, legendary World War II commander, and that was General Patton. And right now, Kevin Hemel is working on a book focusing exclusively on General Patton's experiences during World War II, titled Patton's War. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Kevin.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me okay?
Let's bump them up a little bit there. Yeah, we're cool. Good. All right. Well, we got to get to everybody here. And the next one in line is Colonel William Latham. Bill Latham is a military historian. Of course he is. He's a retired Army officer, and, you know, he flew Chinooks.
Ooh.
Have you ever seen one of those?
Oh, yeah. I saw one flying not long ago, Bob, up by Bay City.
By the way, folks, John
Auger.
is, and his dad, Dave, is with us today. But Dave doesn't have a microphone. He just gets to shake his head and smile away. And, boy, I can tell father and son right here. John's in the studio with me. He's the curator of the Michigan Military and Space Museum. So John will be jumping in, you guys. But William Latham, Bill Latham, is a military historian, retired Army officer, and a veteran of Desert Storm. Ooh, boy, we never did talk about all that. He's published works on a variety of military topics, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. Bill currently teaches at the Army Logistics University at Fort Lee, Virginia. He lives in Virginia, just outside of Washington, with his wife and family. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Bill.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. And holding up the anchor man right here, Professor John John. I'll get it. There we go. John McManus. Whoa. Oh, we lost. Oh, okay. Well, we'll get him back in just a second. John McManus is a military history professor at the Missouri University of Science and Technology. He's written numerous books, and by the way, folks, his books are great. Alamo and the Ardennes. Let me get his list out here real quick.
I can tell you some of them.
They call this dead air in the business, folks. Well, I don't seem to have that list at my head. But
John is Americans on D-Day.
There
Americans
you go.
Normandy. He's got one out right now about the Holocaust that I'm reading, about the GIs witnessing the concentration camps. And one of my favorites is Alamo and the Ardennes, about the Battle of the Bulge. And then there's September Hope, about Americans in
The Bridge Too Far.
There you go. John's got an impressive resume.
John, there's your colleagues. Welcome to Veterans Radio. Did we get him back? Oh, okay. Well, let's
he's
just...
waiting on the call.
Yeah, well, he somehow his call dropped. So she's trying very hard. But the first, how this is going to go, folks, is that each one of our historians is going to give our military leaders, commanders, up to 10 points, and they can give a half a point on what it is to be grit, what it is to be a badass, and how do these gentlemen get to do the things that they did, and you know it when you're sending. I'll never forget the all about Eisenhower, and you know he was such a lonely man. After he said let's do it, they all left the room and left him there. And you know, what do you do? You can't stop it, and you make that decision. So there has to be some basic character on those folks. But anyway, the first one we do. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Ah, good. We got our communications back. All right. And happy Valentine's Day to all of you gentlemen and your families. Right? Right. Okay. Here we go. First one up. And I'm going to start with John McManus because we're going to talk about Bastogne first and General McCollum. And I want to ask one question of you, John. Did he really say nuts?
Yes, he did. Anthony McAuliffe was well known throughout the Army for not being profane. And, of course, I think all of you know quite a bit about profanity in the Army, how pervasive it tends to be, and certainly in that era.
Oh, no, no.
No, shocking, right? And so McAuliffe was known for being, you know, sort of understated. And so, you know, the whole thing comes from, of course, when the Germans issued a surrender ultimatum to the 101st Airborne when they were surrounded. McAuliffe was the temporary commander. Maxwell Taylor was back in Washington, D.C., and McAuliffe had initially thought that the request was some Germans wanting to surrender to Americans. And when his staff told him, no, that wasn't quite the case, he said, us surrender on nuts. And so when it came time to send a message back to the German commander, Harry Kennard, who was his operations officer, said, you know, that first thing you said would be hard to beat, nuts. And so that's what they did.
Okay, I believe that. And I would think there might have been something else, but it wasn't, and that's the way it was. It was nuts. He had no compunction. He was not going to surrender. And how, John, was he able to hold that together at Bastogne, hold those guys and keep their spirits in a fighting way? How does he able to do that, John?
Well, I think there's a couple of factors involved. One is that eventually he's got pretty good air support, which is, you know, hindering many of the German attempts to overrun the city. Plus, the Germans are really kind of stretched out too thin and surrounding the town and also attempting to move on beyond Bastogne. And I think the other thing is that when you look at the experience of the average soldier, most of the guys who were part of the 101st at Bastogne would probably tell you that the tougher fighting, the bigger crisis they had was later on, once they had to expand from Bastogne and the siege was no longer happening and they were the ones attacking and thus exposing themselves to enemy fire. In the case of the siege of Bastogne, it only goes on for about 5.5 days or so, so they were able to kind of hang on and get a little bit of air support, supplies dropped in too. You know, if it had gone on another 2-3 weeks, maybe that would have been a different matter altogether. But McAuliffe does a really nice job of holding the unit together, you know, at a pretty difficult time.
And what other notable can we look at for he was a colonel, right?
No, he was a brigadier general at that point. He was actually the third in command of the division and had ascended to the temporary command.
Artillery commander.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, Bill, do you want to comment on General McAuliffe?
Well, I think McAuliffe is interesting because as a division commander, he subsequently leads the 103rd Division not only across the Alps to capture, or through the Alps anyway, to capture Innsbruck, Austria, but then at the close of the war, his troops seized the Brenner Pass, the famous Brenner Pass linking Italy and Northern Europe, and thus links up the Allied armies, links up with the Allied armies coming up through Italy.
And
a long hope for linkage that really doesn't happen until the very last days of the European campaign. But I think it's noteworthy that McAuliffe covers so much ground.
Now, what happened to him afterward, after Bastogne? We don't hear much about General McAuliffe, or do we?
Well, he actually has a series of rather offbeat assignments. He's chief of the Chemical Army Chemical Corps. He's head of the Army G1. He comes back to Europe as the commander of 7th Army in 1953 and ultimately becomes the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army Europe in 1955. But those are, you know, I mean, Europe was a hot assignment during the Cold War. We're always concerned about the Soviets coming across the Fulda Gap and threatening Western Europe. And so those are high priority jobs, but compared to some of his other famous contemporaries, McAuliffe seems to be a step behind. I defer to John and Kevin for more expertise on the commanders in Europe, but McAuliffe seems to be overlooked somewhat compared to some of his peers.
And how about integrity, and how about communication with the men, Bill?
Well, I mean, I believe John mentioned earlier that McAuliffe is known for not using swear words, that speaks well to his sense of decorum. He does not have, to my knowledge, the reputation as one of the boys, as perhaps Terry Allen or some of the other commanders have a more colorful reputation. But I've never read or heard of his peers speaking ill of McAuliffe.
Well, I think that says a lot. Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, with McAuliffe, he's so thrust into a position of responsibility that was, you know, neither planned nor foresaw, really. Everybody thought the war was winding down. But the thing I'd like to mention about him that impressed me, and this isn't the most pleasant of things, but McAuliffe had trucks driving the perimeter of Bastogne, removing the dead bodies of the Americans, because he didn't want the Germans to think that the 101st were taking the heavy casualties that they were in this battle. He didn't want them to know how effective they were being. And I thought that took incredible foresight by him as a commander. And then sort of as a sidebar to that, they would have to bring those bodies to his headquarters. And when the Germans came in to, you know, give this surrender notice, they had to gather a bunch of medics to get the bodies out of there, because once again, they didn't want that witnessed. This was actually told to me by a medic with the 101st when we took him to McAuliffe's headquarters. So, you know, McAuliffe was in a position when surrounded, I think, that, you know, he really could not afford to make a mistake. You know, he was on the defensive. The Germans were pretty thinly spread out, but the Americans didn't know that. They, you know, to them, the Germans basically had this area surrounded and the advance was pushing further west. And he really was in a tough position and kind of held his chin up and did everything did everything right in a very tenuous situation. And, you know, I whatever accomplishments he made after that battle, that was really his seminal moment that he's going to really be remembered for. Like I said, I know that he did continue on in the Army long after the war and retired, maybe not to any glamorous position, but he stayed Army Green, and I've never read a bad word about him.
Hey, this is John Auger.
Right. He, you know, he ends up as a 4-star general. He retired, so he had quite a career. And in terms of his personal comportment, McAuliffe was an inveterate letter writer, wrote a lot of great letters home to his wife during the war, and, of course, throughout much of his military career, in which it's really very penetrating analysis and honesty about what he was experiencing. He was a kind of a religious man, and he was not someone for whom you're going to find a lot of dirt in his personal life. He had this kind of enduring integrity, I think it's fair to say, that you see throughout much of his career.
Well, folks, You know, you're hearing it right here. That was one of the, you hear this a lot, though, that was the greatest battle of World War. But that truly was going to change everything had the Germans had been successful crossing the Meuse. I think they were headed for...
They were headed for Antwerp, Bob.
Antwerp.
Yeah. Oh, this is John Auger, by the way, from the Military and Space Heroes Museum up in Frankenmuth, Michigan.
And so they were, if they would have taken Antwerp, they could have sued for peace. And so he was a person of the moment. Okay, 1 to 10, you can give halves. Let's start with John. John, what do you give General McAuliffe?
You mean in terms of his overall excellence, or?
What?
Yeah, I would give him an 8.5.
8.5, okay. And Bill?
Oh, I give him a 9. He rose to the occasion at a moment when we needed a great leader.
Kevin?
I'll go with 9 also, just because I want to be like the gang.
Okay, what do we got, 5 minutes? Yeah, all right. I think we're going to go right through the news. Is that all right? Can we do that? Yeah, we're going to do that. We're just going to go right on through. So we'll take a break, though, at the halfway part and play a spot and all that. Anyway, so, okay, that's a grand total of 26.5, I believe. That's exactly good. That out of 30 gave him a high score. And next, you folks were talking about the Pacific. We need something about more things in the Pacific. All right, so we got that. And one... The first one in mind is Bull Halsey. Yeah. Admiral Halsey. He was an admiral. Was he captain?
Yeah. Admiral Halsey.
Okay. He did the admiral thing. But I mean, we see this guy, and there he is on the bridge. And by the way, I got one of those hats. You can buy one. They're really cool. Those hats, they got a wide brim. They're really neat. And they're... He always looked in command, and he was Bull, right? He was, but Lady Gulf, he went chasing the Japanese north, away from Lady Gulf, Leyte, L-E-Y-E-T-T-E, leaving the troops there on the beaches to fend for themselves, essentially. Halsey's going north chasing a phantom. I don't think it was even a full Japanese fleet. And leaving Lady almost unprotected. Wow, tell us about that. Let's start with John. John, tell us about that.
Yeah, Halsey has a reputation in the Navy as being very aggressive, and he certainly earns that at Leyte Gulf. What's interesting is that he would have been in command at Midway, and he was down with sickness at that point, and Admiral Spruance, Raymond Spruance, got the job and obviously wins this victory. But at the time, many felt that he had let the Japanese off easy by letting them escape after being beaten up so badly in the Battle of Midway. And many had said, you know, if Halsey had been here, that wouldn't have happened. He would have chased them down. And so I always thought it was ironic that, if, you know, a couple of years later at Leyte, Halsey has taken the task for being just what he is. I mean, he takes the Third Fleet up north of Leyte and chases what were stripped-down Japanese carriers. It was a whole fleet, but... the Japanese had lost so many planes in previous battles that year that, yes, they were going to use these carriers at bait and then try and move in a fleet to rake over the landing beaches at Leyte, and ultimately the Japanese fail. But most historians, I think it's fair to say, do believe Halsey makes the wrong call there. But overall, he was, you know, I don't think there's any question, he was an excellent, determined commander. And just in my opinion, I think one of the things that lends best toward him is that he worked very well with Douglas MacArthur, and not everyone could do that. It wasn't always their fault. Halsey found a way to work very well. These are two very strong-willed, tempestuous personalities who, believe it or not, got on very, very well.
How about it, Kevin?
And I'd like to point out, you know, Halsey definitely has a roller coaster career in World War II because of Leyte and... for having the guts to take on two hurricanes and losing, or two typhoons and losing. But, you know, I think you can almost draw a parallel with McAuliffe, sort of that correct leader at the right time. And what I mean by that is Admiral Gormley was in command at Guadalcanal, and he's basically abandoning the Marines, more concerned about his ships than getting the supplies to the Marines and sort of winning that campaign. And so Nimitz steps in, fires Gormley, and puts Halsey in charge. And, you know, Halsey, his first message to the fleet, and it's, you know, considered now politically incorrect, but it's kill Japs, kill Japs, kill more Japs. And kind of puts that iron in the spine of the Marines and the Navy pilots and everyone in that major campaign. And I think it was sort of, you know, it's kind of like Patton coming into North Africa, you know, after Fredenhall got beat, and kind of putting that iron in the spine of the troops. And I think that really was a turnaround in the Pacific and desperately needed at the time, because things were not going well for us at Guadalcanal. And I think it's a great example of a leader's personality turning a tough situation around.
And folks, I think it was migraines, right? Isn't that his medical?
He had poison oak.
Was it chronic migraines? Was that it?
I think it was poison oak. I could be wrong. That kept him out of Midway, right?
Right, but wasn't there one battle where he couldn't come on the bridge because I thought it was a migraine anyway. As far as Halsey, we certainly find him. And by the way, folks, when he went to chase the Japanese, tell me, guys, if I'm not mistaken, but wasn't there a big typhoon that he ran into, and they called that Halsey's typhoon? Is that correct, Bill Latham?
That is correct. He ignored warnings, sailed into the typhoon, and lost three destroyers and almost 800 sailors. Really not his finest moment. And I give Halsey a lot of credit for having the foresight to appreciate the importance of the aircraft carrier and naval aviation prior to and in the early days of World War II. Not every U.S. or Japanese or European commander had that level of foresight. So I think Halsey earns credit for that, and he certainly says the right things and becomes an American hero during the early years of the war when we needed heroes. But I also think we can't let him off the hook for either sailing into that typhoon or for chasing the decoy fleet at Leyte Gulf. One of the aspects of World War II at sea, naval warfare in the 19th and 20th century becomes an increasingly technical pursuit. And it does, I think, require more foresight and more planning and more of an appreciation of how weather and enemy activity interact. And so I would argue that perhaps Spruance is exactly the right guy at Midway, and the complaining that Halsey would have pursued and destroyed the Japanese fleet is just talk. It's hard to fault Spruance at Midway. Halsey, on the other hand, has big achievements, but also big failures.
I know we had the captain of the Dewey, a destroyer, on the program, Gary Lilly did, about 5 years ago. And, folks, this destroyer rolled farther over than any ship had ever done before, or I think even since, and still come upright. It rolled over so far that water came in the funnels.
Wow.
How about that, huh?
That's pretty far.
That's, in fact, we had the captain, and you can find that on our archives, folks. Just go to veteransradio.net, and he was talking about how they were standing on, I guess they call them bulkheads, right?
Yeah,
they were standing on the bulkhead. So it was quite a deal to be in that typhoon. And all right, let's time to grade. All right, let's go with John. John, Bull Halsey, what do you got?
I would give him an 8.
Kevin?
6.
And Bill?
7.
7.
Mm-hmm.
7.
Got it. Okay. Well, and we're going to keep going, right? We can keep going. Yeah, we don't have to go to the news. Let's just keep going. Why not? what the heck? It's my program. I can do what I want to do. Now, I've got, looking here. And by the way, I have my 1st Division shirt on. And I also brought my 101st Airborne cap. I was in both outfits.
There you go.
And John over at the museum, what do you folks have? Do you have any naval stuff there?
Oh yeah, we've got a little bit of everything over there. We've got Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Air Force. We got astronauts. You know, we've got a little bit of all of it. One of our newest displays out there is a man by the name of Shinnis Bennett, who wanted to join the Navy at 17 years old and 43. His parents wouldn't sign for him. He gets drafted at 18 and 44, ends up in the Army over in the Battle of the Bulge, gets out of the Army, joins the Coast Guard, goes into the Navy for Korea in the mid-50s, joins the Coast Guard again, and then in the mid-60s, gets out of that and goes into the Merchant Marine until 1983. He just came in a little while ago. Unfortunately, he's suffering from some dementia now, and he's, you know, in his 90s. But he served in four different branches of the United States military.
And that's the kind of stuff you have at the museum.
And Frank, a lot of great stories.
Frankenmuth, Michigan. What's your website?
Our website is www.michigansmilitarymuseum.com.
MichiganMilitaryMuseum.com.
Michigan's with an S. Don't forget
Michigan.
The S, Bob. Might send
no
you
hyphen.
Somewhere else.
No hyphens.
No hyphens.
Okay.
All lowercase.
Michigan's Military. And it's in a little town called Frankenmuth, which is a Bavarian village. Been there forever. Just north of Detroit by about 60 miles. Right, guys?
No, something like that.
Something like that. 90 miles. So
exit 136, I think, gets you there.
It's coming time to be thinking about where you're going to be going for vacation, and one of the stops should be on your list will be the Michigan's Military and Space Museum in beautiful Frankenmuth, Michigan. All right, we're going to be – let's go to another break, and we'll do the legal help on this one. Legal help, and we'll be right back right after this very important message. Oh, yeah, you tell our band director, that was a good call on that one. Yeah, that's, of course, the caissons go rolling, and we were talking about the 101st, and we're talking about the 1st Division. In fact, speaking of the 1st Division, I'm looking here at some of the emails you folks did. Here's one that Alan, oh, where is that? And I think that came from you, Kevin, wasn't it, about Terry Allen. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I mean, I recommended him for the list. I think he's definitely a gritty guy, or full of grits, or what's the word we're looking for here?
Yeah, well, grit.
Grit. There we go. Yep.
He's well, truly. Tell us why, because you made, I mean, it's a big splash here. So tell us all about that.
Well, you know, Terrible Terry Allen was the commander of the 1st Infantry Division in North Africa and Sicily. He, you know, beloved by his soldiers, made smart tactical moves. In fact, after North Africa, he was, you know, it was decided to send him home, and Patton specifically requested Eisenhower not to send him home, that he needed him for Sicily. He wanted a veteran division going in. He did not. He had some green divisions with him, but he said, I need a veteran division to go in. The 1st ID went in at Jella. They got a bad bloody nose. They were not able to capture the airfield they were supposed to on the first day. And so what Terry Allen did, you know, for almost for the first time, he launches a night attack against the Germans, catches them completely off guard, and captures that airfield, then basically drives up the center spine of Sicily, leading the 1st ID the whole way. And, you know, John can speak a little bit better about General Huebner. He just knows him better. But Terry Allen really gave, I think, the 1st ID its identity. Its heritage, for as great a commander as Huebner was, as he, I think Huebner even said, you know, the men liked me, but they loved, you know, Terry Allen. He really engendered a very passionate feeling about the men underneath him, almost to a fault, you know, because in his eyes, his men could do no wrong. So when they were off the line and would party and break up a town, you know, he wouldn't do anything about it. He said, well, my guys fought hard. They're allowed to do this. And that was greeted not very well by Omar Bradley, who really resented the sort of attitude that Allen had instilled in 1st ID. In fact, I think the saying was, The U.S. Army consisted of the 1st Infantry Division and a million replacements. And that's sort of the stamp that Terry Allen put on 1st ID.
Terry Allen. John, have you?
Only a little bit. I've looked him up and just looked at him a little bit. I know he was in World War One as well. Am I correct there?
Kevin, is
Kevin,
that true?
My mind is escaping me. John, Bill, want to chime in?
Bill. Not only was Allen, not only did Allen serve in World War One, but he was wounded in the mouth. He was shot through the jaw and the mouth, and the bullet wound cured him of stuttering, which was
bunked
out of West Point.
We don't recommend that, though. You do that to your teenagers, folks. No, that'll do it, all right. That's an interesting. That's what I love about this. You know, the folks, we've got these gentlemen, and they spend their lifetimes doing this research. You don't have to read the book. Listen to the program.
But they should be books.
We got everybody here.
We want them to go out and buy their books, Bob.
Yeah.
they got to get some royalties.
I didn't mean
sometime.
Their books. I'm talking about the history. Well, no, I better maybe. Bob, how are you going to crawl out of this one? I don't know. We're not. I'm going to get through with this, folks, and we'll. But
let's promote reading, Bob. Let's promote reading.
That's right.
Yes, promote reading. Yes. Okay. But so he was. Was that Marshall that assigned him, Bill? Was that Marshall that assigned him to North Africa?
I
want to know, was he put up against
Marshall
Rommel?
Marshall promoted Brigadier General. He bypassed the rank of Colonel and went straight from Lieutenant Colonel to Brigadier General. kind of a nice move. And that actually happened prior to the war, which is a little unusual. You know, Eisenhower famously went from lieutenant colonel up to two-star general very quickly right after Pearl Harbor. But here Allen is promoted rapidly before the war even began. So his reputation was impressive before the shooting even started. Another great story about Allen from World War One is his appearance. He was a supply officer, and he showed up at an infantry school on the last day of the course. And the course director said, "I don't remember you attending the course." And Allen reportedly said, "Why not? Why don't you remember?" And the officer evidently shrugged and gave Allen credit for attending the course anyway. So, that helped Allen get promoted to major.
You know, folks, it's all these little things that, you know, we talked about grit and it's resolve. And so, yeah, he got caught with his knickers down. But what did he do? He bailed out and he took care of it and he got credit for it. And that's what made these people such strong leaders. And so, you know, when we look at the petulant teenager, it might be a future leader. You never know, man. And these, you know, they didn't want to fail. That's something else, folks, that I found, and I know I can see our three historians shaking their heads. These guys did not know the word fail, and they weren't going to fail. They were going to be going straight ahead. John, you talked about Terry, right, Allen?
You know, I'd like to point out about Terry Allen is this, in terms of his longer-term effect. I really think he was a commander ahead of his time. In his emphasis on the effectiveness of night attacks and on controlling the night in combat, I really think it's fair to say the U.S. Army allows its enemies to control the night from World War One through the end of the Vietnam War until you get into the era of night observation devices towards maybe the tail end of the Vietnam War and certainly by the Persian Gulf War and the 21st century wars, but that. You know, that comes from technology rather than a mindset of we are going to operate and control the night. I think it's a serious weakness in the Army's doctrine and sort of reflects the American culture to some extent. And I think Allen really understood that, and it's one of the reasons why he was an effective commander. His units were good at night attacks, and not just the Brigade One. Eventually, he gets another division during World War II, the 104th. The Timberwolves, and they had an excellent reputation for operating at night, much to the detriment of the Germans. So I think it probably is useful to study Allen and his philosophy, even all these years later.
Bill, well, I know that Hitler had to pull Rommel out of North Africa because he was losing. And I believe in November there was, November 42, there was, I think, Tunisia. And so was that Allen who defeated Rommel, Bill?
Well, I don't think it would be fair to give Allen credit for defeating Rommel. Arguably, the Patton's forces are pushing the Germans from the west, but really, in all fairness, it is General Montgomery's British Eighth Army that really closes the trap door, I would say, on the German Africa Corps, which, you're right, Rommel was reassigned early in 1943, and so he's not there in the final weeks of that campaign. But nevertheless, John makes a great point about the record of the 1st Infantry Division. I think it's also worth noting that Allen is one of the rare commanders who commands in North Africa. He commands in Sicily, and he commands in Europe. Not only that, but he's one of the very few commanders who is fired and then given another command, and commands not one but two divisions successfully. So
tell us about that.
I think that speaks very well for his reputation.
Tell us about being fired, Bill.
Well, I believe Kevin mentioned earlier that Bradley does not care for Allen's approach towards discipline with his troops. And the 1st Infantry Division does, in fact, amass a record of debauchery and misconduct across North Africa. And Bradley does not care for that at all, and lets Allen know that. And so at a critical moment, actually 2 days before he appears on the cover of Time magazine,
wow,
Allen is relieved of command along with Teddy Roosevelt Jr. Mm-hmm. by Omar Bradley. And Bradley tells Marshall he just thinks the division needs a change of personality in command. That not his exact words, but he just thinks the division needs a change. And so Allen and Teddy Roosevelt Jr. are out on their ear.
Bill, can I add a little something to that?
Absolutely.
Please.
This is some research I just came across. Because Omar Bradley, in his diaries and letter in his memoir, says that he relieved Allen. And then in my readings of Patton's diaries and letters, it looks like he did it. However, I was doing some research in the National Archives on what's called the Army Green Book series. This is the Army's history of World War II. And the historians that did it conducted a great deal of interviews. And I was looking at a green book, all the notes on it, not related to North Africa or Sicily. And this general, and I just don't have it in front of me, was being interviewed, and he said, oh, by the way, don't put this in the book, but Terry Allen was not relieved of command by Omar Bradley or Patton. After the Battle of Kasserine Pass, General Marshall wanted a combat commander to come back to the United States and start training the U.S. Army. And Patton held on to him as long as he could, but that's the real reason he was taken out of command, was because Marshall wanted him as an experienced combat commander to come back to the States. Another officer involved in the interview said, yes, that's exactly right. I have not seen anything beyond that scope. I really haven't really dug into it, into Marshall's letters or Eisenhower's, but there's a possibility that he was not, cashiered or fired from his command, but instead brought back for a distinct purpose. Now, like I said, this is all raw information I've come across that I haven't really gotten into the research, but I figured I just wanted to add that to the mix.
Well, I've got something to finish up with Terry Allen. This question goes to John McManus. John, when the 101 or the 1st Division came from Africa, they thought that was it. That's it, folks. We've been fighting, and we're going to now. But no, they were told that they weren't going to get rotated. They were told about preparing for, was it D-Day or Italy? Why don't you fill us in on that?
Yeah, they had fought, of course, all the way across North Africa. They had led the way in the invasion of Sicily, had some very hard fighting there, and, of course, there had been the change of commander in that time. So when the Battle of Sicily comes to an end, You know, and Allen is no longer in command, Roosevelt's no longer there, and they have Clarence Hubner in command, and initially they did not like him at all, though eventually they came to highly like and respect him. Many of the veterans began to circulate rumors that they were going to go home and train people, just like Kevin was saying about Terry Allen going home and training others. Many members of the Big Red One felt the Army owed that to them. And so when the convoy begins to sail beyond Gibraltar and doesn't continue west in the Atlantic but makes a northward turn, most everybody knew what that meant. And it was a very, very somber mood aboard those ships.
How did Allen hold them together?
How did Allen hold it together personally?
I mean, these guys were not happy.
Well, it wasn't Allen at that point. It's Clarence Hubner.
Let's go right into him. Go ahead.
Yeah, Hubner had taken over during the end of the Sicily campaign by August 1943. And, you know, it's quite interesting. He and Allen got along very well. They did not undercut each other at all, though obviously Allen was leaving under bad circumstances. Hubner had the highest respect for Allen, but he also felt that the division needed some changes. For instance, rifle marksmanship. Hubner was a near fanatic about that, and he felt that there had been some slipshod discipline in terms of understanding weapons training, training for the job of the one or two people ahead of you when casualties happen, things like that, physical fitness. So Hubner implements a kind of a Spartan regimen upon a unit that felt that it had been there and done everything in combat and knew what it was doing. So he's telling experts, you can be better. And initially, they don't like hearing that. So it was tough for him to hold it together, but I think ultimately, when they saw that Hubner knew exactly what he was talking about, that he subjected himself to the same training, that he was totally dedicated, and when they saw it pay off on D-Day, this really, I think, keeps the division's camaraderie even higher than it otherwise would have been.
So Hubner, Kevin, Hubner was the commander of the, I keep wanting to say the 101st, no. The 1st Division, there we are.
Big Red One.
Right, the Big Red One. I know I was a member, remember. At Omaha, that was Hubner. Is that right, Kevin?
That is correct. In fact, I was just reading a diary of a chaplain who, after D-Day, a few days after D-Day, drove across the American lines. He said he went between the 29th Division, the 1st Infantry, and the 2nd Infantry. And he said that the difference of the battlefields were amazing. He said the 1st Infantry Division, the houses were not as blown up. You could tell these soldiers were very efficient getting through the areas. He said the 29th Infantry Division, which was very highly trained but inexperienced, he said the buildings were blasted heavily at first, but then as you sort of travel inland, you can see how they learn not to just blow everything up and, you know, really focus on the enemy. And then he said the 2nd Infantry Division, which was not as highly trained, everything was just blown up in their area. And he said, well, they'll learn, but I thought it was interesting, this perspective of driving across three division areas and just seeing how the 1st Infantry, you know, just from the wake of their battles, that he was able to tell how professional they were.
I'm going to go back to John McManus. John, things were dire on Omaha, and they were almost being thought about being pulled out. How close, and how did Hubner, there we go. How did he overcome that? They were on the ropes. What happened? Tell us about that.
Hubner has trained that division to a winning standard by the time of D-Day. Hubner, as the division commander, is not and cannot be there personally to lead these guys during the worst hours on the morning of June 6, 1944. But he has created a whole series of accountable leaders all the way down to the squad leader level. That's just sort of the culture of the division. They have a muscle memory about how to react under these difficult circumstances. They know they're going to be well supported at the staff level. And so they're really equipped to deal with the worst. Hubner comes ashore that night. I wrote about this in a book about the Big Red One at Omaha Beach. And he's briefed by a staff officer telling him all about what had happened during that terrible day. Hubner had been like a caged lion aboard his ship, wanting to get ashore, but they knew that was a bad idea. So he comes ashore about 6 p.m., and when he's briefed, he's almost overcome with emotion, you know, certainly for the tragedy of what happened, but he was so proud of what his soldiers accomplished. And I think really from that moment forward, there's this kind of two-way street to the relationship whereas they didn't like him. They didn't know who he was or what he was about. They had a misimpression that he was a stateside guy who had no combat experience. Actually, Huebner was arguably the most highly decorated combat commander in the American Expeditionary Force in World War I, and he had served in the Big Red One. So he knew what he was doing, and of course this personality comes forward and is really one of the best success stories in the U.S. Army during World War II, in my opinion.
Folks, they were on the ropes, but there was nothing going to beat the U.S. Army that day, or the whatever, you know, the Navy, the whole. It was just to be. And the thing about, I can see now, I didn't know who was, to be honest with you, who the commander was, and what he instilled in those soldiers is to put that fear aside and to become an army of one. And there were so many instances of the 1st Infantry Division and faced under heavy fire, and just not just courage, but they weren't going to be defeated. John, Auger, you're shaking your head.
Well, no, I was agreeing with you, but sounds like Huebner, he had a lot of that grit, and he instilled what else he had. He instilled that grit right into all of his men so that they knew and they could take over. If their squad leader was gone, the next guy pop right up and say, let's go. Follow me.
Real quick, tell us about that, John McManus.
That's absolutely what happens at Omaha Beach, because as we all know, the casualty rates were terrible that morning. And so, you know, you quickly have squad leaders leading platoons, platoon leaders dealing with running companies, so on and so forth. You have ad hoc units because people are mixed up, in which leaders come to the fore. I mean, I could go on and on and on about this. There's all sorts of examples of junior officers who perform heroically, but also privates. And this is just what we know about. There's probably hundreds of stories we'll never know about because the participants never told them or did not survive. Huebner ends up, you know, ultimately promoted to Corps Command a few months after D-Day. He concludes the war very successfully as the 5th Corps Commander. So he's a man who really has a very distinguished Army career without ever attending West Point, and had begun as a private soldier when he originally joined the Army in the early 20th century.
Well, it's time to vote, folks. Okay, Kevin, Terry Allen.
Terry Allen, I'll give a 9, only because he had difficulties later at the end of the Sicily campaign. Huebner, I will give a 10.
Let's go, Bill.
I'll echo the 9 and the 10. I agree completely.
John McManus?
I agree.
John McManus?
That is my assessment as well. I agree with Bill and Kevin.
You should.
That's the first time we've had a perfect 30.
I see that.
Somebody. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go to that quick PSA we got, and then we'll come back and finish this all up. Stretch it. We don't. Where's that CD with the PSA? No, we can't.
Let's talk about patent, Bill.
Oh yeah.
Let's save that for the next program. No.
Never heard of him.
There is one thing I wanted to ask about patent. And because, I mean, we're going to spend some time on him when we do take him. I mean, the guy,
that's a whole
iconic
program, Bob.
I mean, is everything, really. But he had something, and we've only got 2 minutes, so it's got to be quick. But Yank Magazine, he wanted to pull that publication. What was that all about, Kevin?
Well, during the North African campaign, Yank Magazine put on its cover, the hard-fighting common soldier and all the difficulties he's dealing with. And it was basically a picture of a GI kind of squatting down by a sterno fire with his – this is really horrendous, so brace yourselves, guys. His sleeves were rolled up. His top button was not buttoned, and he wasn't wearing a helmet. So you can imagine how infuriated General Patton is to see a soldier under his command looking just an ounce worth of slovenness. And that just enraged Patton, and he – wanted nothing to do with Yank, didn't want their reporters on the front lines, wanted the magazine squashed. Fortunately, it didn't happen, but that little incident is a perfect sort of crystallization of George S. Patton, who I'm going to call the King of Grit.
Well, folks, we've come to the end of another program, and it's going to be our I'm going to ask these guys back. We got to keep doing this. This is great stuff. Bill Latham, I want to thank you very much for being on our program again. And watch out, the storm's coming your way. Bill?
Thanks.
Hmm?
Thanks for nothing.
The storm, right. John, real quick, your last couple words. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to be on the same program with these fine gentlemen.
Okay, Kevin, you got 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Always glad to be part of this team. I have a lot of fun with it. Thanks, guys.
Well, we had a lot of fun with you. Folks, you're listening to Veterans Radio again next week. Same time, Dale will be back. This is Bob Gould. You are dismissed.